welcome to another edition of the Scholars Podcast, Conversations with Inspiring Leaders. Today's guest is Professor Catherine Daniel. Catherine is a professor at the ANU's School of Cybernetics, Institute for Water Futures, and the Fenner School of Environment and Society. Her expertise spans various continents and domains, from Europe to the Asia Pacific. Professor Daniel focuses on working across boundaries and having collaborative approaches to policy, action, and education for sustainable development. Her extensive research portfolio encompasses international science and technology cooperation, water governance, cybernetics, AI-enabled systems, risk management, sustainable urban development, and climate change adaption. Not only is Catherine deeply involved in academia, but she also plays pivotal roles in fostering cooperation and innovation. She was one of the original John Monash Scholars, having gone through the scholarship program back in 2005. Professor Daniel, Catherine, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Justin. Lovely to be here.
So you were born in Canberra, educated in South Australia, have lived and worked overseas, and are now back in Canberra. That's quite the journey. So tell us about the work you're specifically doing now.
So at the moment, I'm at the Australian National University. I came back after my John Monash Scholar, and I've worked my way around the university. At the moment, as you mentioned, I'm in the ANU's newest school, which is the ANU School of Cybernetics. Cybernetics is a domain that looks at complex systems and the interactions between humans, the environment, and technology. And so it's a way of really understanding and navigating the kind of really complex and risky situations that we're in at the moment.
Do you have to describe to your friends what it is you actually do when they say, what are you teaching now? And you say, cybernetics, do they understand what that is?
I mean, I think it's a great way of starting a conversation. One of the challenges we've got in this world is that everything's so difficult to do. And so one of the things that I teach is, how do you convene interesting conversations between different people? And then how do you turn that into a plan for action to change things in the world? So we're teaching students about what it's like to think about different cultures, different perspectives, their own blind spots, and how you work with other people who are really different from you. And all of those kinds of skills are the things that you need in boardrooms, that you need in public policy offices, that you need when you're developing a startup, because you never do it alone. You always have to work with a bunch of people to change the world. And so I've had this really lovely kind of journey of slowly adding together a range of disciplines, a range of different people, different cultures on the journey to ANU.
I know you're still actively involved in research. Can you tell us about the research that interests you at the moment, what you're doing at the moment, and more broadly, the approach that you take to a research topic?
So I typically work in collaborative settings when I do research. I'm really interested in people who have challenges in the world. So a lot of the research that I do will be working with partners. They might be communities or governments in Pacific Islands. They might be our own government departments. They might be Indigenous communities, say in the Murray-Darling Basin or elsewhere. And so a lot of the work is around building relationships, understanding what people's challenges are, and then using a whole lot of the tools and techniques, including from cybernetics, to say, well, here are some of the ways that we might be able to help develop some viable ways forward for whatever this system is. In water areas, often this is around programs of both decision-making and education that come together. So we might use things like gaming techniques. I used to be a modeler. I originally did civil engineering and arts and made a whole lot of complex systems models. We realized that often when people look at those models, they don't understand what's in them. They're not particularly interested in the outputs. And so over time, we started to develop much lower tech models. They would be things like using stones and beads and pieces of cardboard to be able to develop a river basin system, or to be able to map out, say, an island water system, and then be able to play through all of the different options and climate change elements and issues with ecosystem damage and how the conflicts occur over sharing water. But it's very, very tactile. So people play. And we've had, you know, ministers playing with beads. We are able to take it into schools to talk to kids about the water cycle. And so these are the kinds of ways that I like to do research. Some of the other things we've been doing recently are about thinking about some of the biggest kind of challenges we have. How do you do things like safely, responsibly, and sustainably scale artificial intelligence technologies and robotics?
Have you figured that out yet?
Yeah, just, you know, just a little challenge in the world at the moment.
Good luck with that.
Thank you. And so, yeah, we use some alternative techniques, looking at things that we call, for example, cybernetic prehistories, where rather than looking at artificial intelligence now, we'll look at something like the steam engine. And we'll see, well, how did the steam engine develop, be taken off a mine shaft, put into a little, miniaturized to be put onto a train. We had to create railway systems. The railway systems then created huge changes in society. We had to develop ticketing systems and economics and a range of legislation. And then, you know, railways changed the world. And so by looking at a system like the railways, or my colleagues have been looking at something like Australia's Telegraph, we're able to think about the whole phase and range of scaling over a certain amount of time. And then that allows us to think about, all right, well, what would happen? What could happen with our artificial intelligence technologies that we're only kind of, you know, in the first part of? Artificial intelligence has been around since at least kind of the 1950s in different ways. But it's really kind of taking off at the moment. So by looking at other places around the world where technological change has taken off, then sometimes it's subsided. It's not necessarily inevitable. It's really fascinating. One of the little stories we tell people about when they go, oh, AI is going to take over, it's going to be inevitable that it's going to be everywhere, we say, well, even with the steam engine, you know, it went into boats, it went into trains, but did you know that there are about 7 attempts at steam planes? And they just didn't take off.
So, literally.
Literally. They didn't take off. And so I think that really shows that, you know, we can use some of these understandings of dynamics from history to look at, you know, what might work, what might not, what we want to be our futures, and how we're going to build them together.
So you mentioned AI. It's obviously a hot topic issue no matter where you are. Governments of the world are trying to grapple with the technology, how it fits in, how to work with AI. In your experience, are you collaborating, academics collaborating with governments to try to solve this problem together?
Absolutely. I think there's been a lot of work in many sort of particularly government-funded research projects over the last decade or so to be looking at some of the challenges and opportunities for the development of artificial intelligence systems. We were involved fairly recently in a European-funded project looking at algorithmic policy futures, understanding the differences and ways that, for example, the European Union has been trying to legislate around the risks linked to artificial intelligence. And then comparing some of those practices with Australian processes, getting together a range of academics, and the school that I'm in, School of Cybernetics, is a place where we really encourage mixing and people moving from policy to industry to academia. And one of our current staff members has been seconded to the ministry. So it's really a way of showing that we can be working on these challenges together. We're particularly interested in how to educate people around these technologies. They're now part of our daily lives. How can we not be scared of them and start to have a vocabulary to talk about them? So in particular, we've got a number of small, what we're calling learning experiences that enable people from the public or government departments or industry groups to get a bit of a set of skills around how do I talk about an artificial intelligence system? What's the data behind it? What are the algorithms? What's the tech stack that's underneath it? How does it sense and do its work? So we really try to help unpack it so that people understand what's going on around them. Then they can choose whether or not they want to resist it, be a part of it, and how they might be able to use it more appropriately in their daily lives.
Catherine, among your many talents, one of your fields of expertise is what you like to call working across boundaries. For the benefit of our listeners, what does this mean and how has this developed over the years?
That's a great question, Justin. I think when I was reflecting on our little chat about this earlier, I realized that boundaries are created by society. Often when we're in a schoolroom, we have a whole bunch of subjects. Maths will be separated from science, will be separated from English, will be separated from history. And as we go through life, often we are channeled into specializing in particular areas. We're also channeled into living in particular cultures. We have one particular system. But some people have the real benefits and chances of being able to cross over all of these different areas and bring them together. And so I was particularly lucky in my upbringing that I had parents who had different domains of expertise. My dad was a civil engineer. My mum was a librarian and a school teacher. She taught history and German and English. And I think they always encouraged me to connect my interests. And so when I went to university, I realized that I'd accidentally taken the two degree programs that my parents had. So I did civil engineering and arts together. And through that, I was able to keep some of the French language and culture that I'd been doing at school, plus do a whole lot of subjects and things that enabled me to look at the environment, understand the world around me, how to build things. But the arts degree really allowed me to think about how to reflect on the world in a critical way. And so when I went and did my the PhD under the John Monash Scholarship, I kind of took the same approach. I went, well, I'm not quite sure what I want to do when I grow up, but apart from that, I really want to make a difference to the world. I want to make sure we can connect policymakers and community members to deal with some of our biggest sustainability challenges. And that was kind of my objective. And so I found some great groups around the world that hadn't put up all these structures of disciplines. And I was working in a really great French group in Montpellier that's now called Water Matters. And that was an amazing group of researchers where they had sociologists who were originally engineers, they had mathematicians who'd become anthropologists, lots of modelers and complex systems people. And it was just this environment where boundaries didn't matter. It was about the challenges and the people and the processes. And equivalently, I was also linking up with the Australian National University to do part of my John Monash Scholarship. And that, again, was an area where those boundaries didn't matter. We could work across cultures. We could work across disciplines. And I think what I realized from that is that when we want to deal with the world's biggest problems, we can't work in silos. You know, the government doesn't necessarily work when all the silos are disconnected. You know, humans and their environments and their technological systems, they're all a whole. And this is where that idea of developing a new school, School of Cybernetics, comes from, is that we don't need to have these boundaries. We can transform them. We can work across them. We can work with industry and academia and government and community all together. We don't have to separate them off.
And do you think, Catherine, that as a whole, the universities, certainly in Australia, have become better at developing courses where you can work across boundaries? So it's no longer just, I want to be a lawyer, or I want to be an accountant, or I want to be a scientist. I can study mathematics, but also do Mandarin and, you know, AI as well, and, you know, study water. I'd like your opinion on that.
I do think we're getting better at it. I think Australia's been relatively innovative in this area. I mean, I've been particularly lucky and grateful that I've fallen into a whole lot of places where it has been possible to do this. I know many academics do struggle in that there are particular disciplinary boundaries that are very strongly policed by the people in those areas. But on the whole, I think there is a movement towards the need for people to not just have deep expertise in one area, but a lot of expertise in how to bridge across different areas. And so I think there have been some really innovative programs that have started up around a range of universities in Australia, but there's a lot more opportunity to do that. I think now just the numbers of people doing double degrees or triple degrees or multiple degrees one after the other really helps people to build that kind of systemic awareness of the world. They've got all of these different perspectives that they're able to put at play. And particularly, I think Australia's been quite good in some areas about global exchanges. And of course, the John Monash Scholarship Program is one that encourages Australians to go overseas and to bring back and to see that expertise, those different perspectives, those different cultural ways of understanding how a research system or a government system works. And that's an extraordinarily rich thing for Australia. I love the fact that the old Colombo program was renewed as the new Colombo program, people being able to study and exchange in the Asia Pacific region, because I think over time, having more and more people who have had those intercultural experiences have understood that systems are contextual. They work differently in different places. People are different in different places. My personality in France is completely different from my personality in Australia. I think it's really nice for people to recognize that we can be multiple people in different places and we can do multiple things. And often there are real synergies between all of that life and work.
Here would be the time for me to break out some of my French, but alas. You touched on the scholarship. Let's briefly reminisce on that, if we can. You were awarded a scholarship, I said in my introduction, in 2005. You studied for a PhD. Tell us about your experience.
So as I mentioned, my PhD was based in Montpellier. I was at what was then called INGRET, or Agro-Paris-Tech, which was an engineering and management school over in France. Because I like working across boundaries, I was able to negotiate to remain connected to Australia during that period. So I spent 1 out of the 3.5 years in Canberra at the Australian National University. But I also had links to the CSIRO and another research, the National Research Organization in France, actually two of them. So I had 5 main supervisors, 5 main institutions, plus a bunch of advisors to work and negotiate my topic across. And so I ended up
the admin horror associated with that, Catherine.
Yes, but I think that there's something really delightful about how to learn to wrangle administrative systems. I know that having sort of had to manage many of the French systems, it set me really up really well to work in Australian universities because they're also pretty similar in their sort of bureaucratic wrangling needs. The topic that I was looking at was around river basin management and how do we improve water governance in order to connect the policymakers to the communities and not just impose decisions on them. So it was really about how to organise really large-scale collaborative processes between a whole range of different stakeholders, policymakers, ministers, in some cases oyster farmers, government officials, mayors, flooded and drought-affected citizens. And I did this in Bulgaria, in Australia, and in France.
But you've got a few stories from Bulgaria.
Absolutely, but there are probably stories that shouldn't be repeated on a podcast.
It's another podcast.
That's right. No, Bulgaria was fabulous. And it was just the time when they were entering the European Union. So an area or a time of absolutely massive social transformation. And so that just provided a real opportunity to test things out, to be innovative, to see whether they were interested in applying processes and ways of thinking and doing that they would have never expected, because there were opportunities at the end of that. There was going to be so much change that they thought they were able to change anyway.
reflecting on all of that, the scholarship work and your various studies, how has your career journey and your educational experiences informed your approach to the work that you're doing today?
I think there are some really basic things that the John Monash Scholarship made me reflect on. Just after I received the award, I found out that my great-grandfather had fought under General Sir John Monash in the First World War.
Really?
And he'd been on the Western Front. And so one of the first memories of the program and scholarship I have is of, you know, my grandparents being so proud and my parents being so proud of it. I kind of didn't understand what that was at the time, but we were able to convince my grandmother and my great aunt, who had never been to France, to the Western Front, to come over in my first year of the Monash Scholarship. And so they came to France. We went to the Australian Embassy. There are a bunch of three other Monash Scholars from the first couple of years of the program who all met together, and we went up in this bus to the fields. And I think it had been really important because I'd been reading his letters. They'd been able to find a whole lot of my great-grandfather's letters. And he talked about in the letters Sir John Monash and how, you know, he wouldn't just drill and drill and drill all the soldiers when it was winter time, but in fact he wanted to give them an education and look after people so that they would be able to do their best. And I think there was something about both the family connections and going to the places and seeing the relationships and the care between this kind of the French and the Australians that has really stuck with me about the importance of, even if you're in a horrific situation, this care of people and love for each other is something that can create change in the world. You know, there was this old woman when we went to Villa Bretonneux who put her hand on my grandmother's shoulder. She couldn't speak English, but just basically said merci to my grandmother. And so there are those kinds of moments that they mark you in terms of the importance of relationships between countries. And between people. And so a lot of my work, you know, I used to build bridges as a civil engineer, physical ones. But very quickly I realized that it was much more the environments and the people that were of interest to me. And so now I try to build bridges between people, between cultures. And that's really affected my approach in terms of how I go about the work that I do in the world. And that might be, you know, building organizations. When I came back from the John Monash Scholarship to Australia, I really wanted to keep those relationships with France. So I've been able to work with the embassy, French embassy in Australia now, for many years to develop a whole range of different initiatives, whether it's about water governance and then more recently an association on, so it's an Australian-French Association for Research and Innovation. And all of that is about developing the relationships around the biggest challenges that both of our countries and indeed regions, so Europe and Pacific and Indo-Pacific, are facing. And that's just been an amazing journey that was really started off by the scholarship. That particular association now almost has 1,000 members. We're working with both governments, with lots of partners, and it's a really exciting opportunity to strengthen those relationships and keep them maintained from the kind of relationships that my family had multiple generations away.
Catherine, what a great story. That's fantastic. Thank you for sharing that. Am I right in saying that you have the equivalent of a French knighthood, a French National Order of Merit? I'm going to embarrass you here, but tell us about that.
Thanks. Yes. So a couple of years ago, I was extraordinarily honoured to receive what was called the Chevalier dans l'Ordre National de Mérite, which is the equivalent, I suppose, of our Australian awards. And that was about the service of developing relationships between France and Australia in research and innovation, but also specifically around water management. I've had huge opportunities over the last decade or so to be able to work with an amazing range of people around the world through a range of different associations, many of those through the French connections. And that's really enabled that development of of strong relationships, of people who we can talk to. There have obviously been some challenging moments in our recent history, but it's also been, I think, whenever we're challenged, there are moments of real growth and recognizing where your values lie. I remember when I heard about the cancelling of the submarine contract, it was difficult. We'd been working for many, many years to build science and technology and research collaboration. And I think what was interesting is in that moment, I realized that I had really, really deeply held values about how much I care about the relationship with France. And so, it wasn't just a contract, it was a relationship and a collection of sort of trust that, you know, could have been managed a lot better. And I think that made me reflect on
with long-lasting consequences, yes.
Absolutely.
You could say.
But I think in some ways, you know, these moments of struggle are also the ones where you find your deepest values. You know, I found my now husband when I went in exchange to France. I have two French-Australian children. And you know, so now that, and we speak French at home, so part of that kind of intercultural experience is now deeply embedded within the way I live. And so it's very interesting. Often you don't think about it until there's a particular, you know, challenge that you've had in relation to that.
A moment in time, yes.
Yeah, I think in some ways that moment strengthened my belief in the need for Australia to relate to many, many countries around the world, to do that in a really respectful way, and to build that trust and relationships. And so I said, well, I'm going to keep doing it. And I have, and many other people have around me. And I think now our relationship is stronger, and there's a lot more we can do.
You've potentially already answered this, but I'd like to touch on it because I don't know what's going to come out. So Catherine, is there an experience from your career that has shaped you professionally or been particularly impactful or memorable that you'd like to share?
I think one of the most important moments I had was when I was sitting in what could have been a rather dry university research committee meeting at the ANU, except that there was this person who was new to the ANU who stood up, and I was so excited to see her. Name was Distinguished Professor Genevieve Bell, and our Deputy Vice Chancellor welcomed her here. And at that moment, there was another professor who stood up and said something that I thought was rather shocking at the time, as did a few of the other people in that particular room. And she recounts that apparently I passed her a note when she asked, you know, who it was. And from that moment afterwards, we went and had a cup of coffee. I said, look, how can I help? You know, you're here at the ANU to try to set up this new innovation institute. And she said, oh, well, you can run some workshops for me. And I said, all right, great. So I ran three workshops for Distinguished Professor Genevieve Bell on autonomy, agency and assurance, the name of this particular institute that had just been set up. And from that moment onwards, we collectively, because she asked for help, started to set up this institute. And this institute was somewhere that then has been able to employ a range of other people, including another John Monash scholar, Amy McLennan. And we developed in the first year a new master's program. This was the Master of Applied Cybernetics. We were told that we couldn't develop a master's program very quickly, but we managed to develop one in 5 weeks, get it through all of the university processes, talking about administrative wrangling. And then we set about starting this program with a bunch of students that we hadn't quite built yet. So it was just this amazing kind of moment of, you know, collective construction, of collaboration, of working across a whole range of boundaries and disciplines to develop this first master's program that had at its focus, you know, these new intelligent systems that we're now sort of calling AI systems. And so, yeah, 5 years ago, We're now in the sixth year of this particular program. We built this huge, you know, master's program. It's become an engine for innovation. We now have a new school of cybernetics. And so I think, you know, there are moments in time where maybe just passing a note or having a cup of coffee can really change the direction of your life. And so this has been an absolutely amazing kind of journey of discovery, being able to bring together all of my passions of bridging different disciplines, working across environments and societies and technologies. And so sometimes, you know, opportunities come along and you have to realize, are they kind of in the direction of where you want to go, the change you want to make in the world? And that this was one particular moment that I think has very much shaped me and my approach to the world, and it's shaping the ANU and I hope one day the world.
Fantastic. You mentioned students there. How do you, you're in the lecture theatre, you're working with them collaboratively. How do you work with your students? I'm keen to get an insider's viewpoint on your approach that you take to lecturing and educating.
So I tend to take a more facilitatory approach. I do, you know, many lecturers are required to do a teensy tiny bit of chalk and talk, but my way might be to give them one slide and then make them teach themselves. And so often, you know, whiteboards will get filled with their suggestions. You know, we might go outside. Last Friday, we're exploring the National Museum with a group of students to understand what they think about it, how they feel about it, what stories.
Love that museum. How good's that museum?
Oh, it's phenomenal. And that's why we take our students out. So I think we also help them build things. So rather than just think about them, a lot of things are very hands-on. We often challenge ourselves most when we're at our edges. And so people who may never have coded before or might be scared of circuits. I know this week in our classroom, we had people doing circuit sewing. So, you know, there are people who are fearful of sewing. There are people who are fearful of circuits. You put them all together and they have a good chat while they're talking. But this is how they then create something. And so everybody learns collectively. And we have in our master's program demo days. And so twice a year, the public comes in to see what the students have been up to and what they've been building. And of course, the students are pretty excited, pretty overwhelmed.
I bet.
By the public. Sometimes we'll have, you know, ambassadors and vice chancellors and other people who come and look at their work. But it gives them something to strive for. They're typically really proud of what they produce, and going through that little bit of struggle enables them to see what they want to build in the world, how it's going to be helpful, what kind of questions they might need to ask of people.
They could be sitting on a $1 billion idea too. You never know.
They could be indeed. And I know that we do have a former vice chancellor who still really wants one of the students' projects, and he continues to ask them every year, I want my AI bird feeder.
Well, we will keep an eye out for that one. Catherine, I could talk to you for hours, but we are out of time. It has been wonderful catching up with you today. We wish you well in your career, your academic journey, and your collaboration with all things French. Professor Catherine Daniel, a John Monash Scholar from 2005, thank you so much for coming onto the show, and have a great year.
Thanks so much, Justin. It was a pleasure.